Morris. I'm Elena Casas.
Thanks, Elena. Nice to hear from you. It's it's Tuesday's programme. It's the 23rd of July 2019, and it is Scorchio. It is 31 degrees outside in Salford and Greater Manchester. It's approaching 45 degrees in the studio. A little bit more on that later on. There might be one or two changes later on in the week, like it or lump it. Anyway, welcome to the programme, live right now on richieallen.co.uk, Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. We're on triggerwarning.tv, TuneIn Radio, and multiple other platforms as well. It's always good to be with you.
Richie Allen.
Yes, it's hot. And I'm hot.
It's the Richie Allen Show. Broadcasting live on richieallen.co.uk and multiple platforms around the world. And now, here's your host, Richie Allen.
Now, to talk about the conviction of Carl Beach yesterday, a.k.a. Nick, for making false allegations to the police about VIP paedophile rings. The barrister, the former barrister, and the former immigration judge, Michael Shrimpton, returns to this programme. Michael, of course, wrote the terrific book Spy Hunter. Michael is going to talk to us about this case. You don't want to miss that. That's coming up this hour. And in the second hour, I'm delighted to welcome back to the programme a true heroine, a remarkable lady. Maggie Oliver returns to the Richie Allen Show to talk about her brand new book, Survivors Fighting for Justice. Maggie spent 16 years as a police officer and detective with the Greater Manchester Police. She blew the whistle on the failures of Greater Manchester Police and how they did not protect child victims of grooming gangs in Rochdale. And you don't want to miss that, Maggie Oliver. Maggie's story, and the story of the girls, importantly, was dramatised by the BBC in 2017 in a series called Three Girls. Maggie Oliver to talk about an outstanding book. I finished it today. It really is. It's as compelling a memoir as I've ever read, and I do mean that. So it's a back Richie Allen Show then. Nothing like it. Europe's most listened to independent radio show. I am Richie Allen. I'm scorching. I'm in my birthday suit. Got the old birthday suit out. The birthday suit. Yeah, I got the birthday suit out. Did I say that, did I? Will I say it again? No? All right. Yes, it's glorious. It's lovely. It's lovely unless you're working. Yeah. And when I get my holiday in August, I bet you it'll be grim up north. It'll be grim. It'll be grim. There's a small problem with the Richie Allen website. The genius that is Hayden Hewitt, who gives of his time for nowt, by the way. You know, Hayden looks after that website and doesn't ask for anything for it. It's going across to a new server, and we're waiting for the SSL to go live. I'll pretend I know what that means. Haven't a clue. Haven't a Scooby-Doo. But Hayden does. Thanks be to God. Valentine tweets, "It's so hot I went back to my ex just for the cold shoulder." Boom, 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 boom. Yeah, that tops anything I could come up with, Valentine. Good stuff. Right, let's move on. There's only one place to start then. Boris Johnson beat Jeremy Hunt comfortably. You might have heard Elena in the news bulletin talking about that. He won with 60-something percent, 65% of the vote, and he is the new leader of the Conservative Party, meaning that tomorrow, Wednesday, he will take over from Theresa May as the Prime Minister. Yes, he will. After Prime Minister's questions tomorrow, Bojo, Boris Johnson, will be yours and mine Prime Minister. In his victory speech, he promised he would deliver Brexit and unite and defeat Jeremy Corbyn. Yes, we're going to get Brexit done, says Boris, on October 31st, on Halloween. We're going to get it done. And it's going to be, well, it's going to be tickety-boo. It's going to be tickety-tickety-boo, says Bojo. Here he is. Here's a snip of his victory speech. Bojo.
I read in my Financial Times this morning that there are no incoming leader has ever faced such a daunting set of circumstances, it said. Well, I look at you this morning and I ask myself, do you look daunted? Do you feel daunted? I don't think you look remotely daunted. To me. And I think that we know that we can do it and that the people of this country are trusting in us to do it, and we know that we will do it.
Yes.
And we know the mantra of the campaign that has just gone by.
What's the mantra of the campaign that's just gone by?
Bye. in case you've forgotten it.
I've forgotten it. What is it?
You probably have.
Yes, I have, I said. What is it?
What
was that? What was the mantra, Boris? Just answer the question.
Deliver Brexit, unite the country and defeat Jeremy Corbyn. And that is what we're going to do.
Yeah, yeah.
And I know some wag was already pointed out that deliver, unite and defeat was not the perfect acronym for an election campaign, since unfortunately it spells dud. But they forgot the final E, my friends. E for energise. And I say to all the doubters, dude, we are going to energise the country. We're going to get Brexit done on October the 31st. We're going to take advantage of all the opportunities that it will bring in a new spirit of can-do. And we are once again going to believe in ourselves and what we can achieve. And like some slumbering giant, we are going to rise and ping off the guy ropes of self-doubt and negativity with better education, better infrastructure, more police, fantastic full fibre broadband sprouting in every household. We are going to unite this amazing country.
Yeah, sprouting inside your brain, 5G, that's what it'll be doing. Well, you've got to admit, dear listener, it's not going to be dull anyway. Even though it doesn't matter a damn, it's not going to be dull. Bojo there. What does Jeremy Corbyn think of all this? Well, Jeremy is going to bide his time. And when he's good and ready, he's going to proffer a vote of, or a motion of, I should say. He's going to proffer a motion of no confidence in Boris Johnson. Here's Corbyn.
We will table one when appropriate to do so. And tomorrow, there will be Prime Minister's question time with Theresa May for the last time. I understand Boris Johnson.
I mean, both of them are establishment to the bone, aren't they? Both Corbyn and Johnson. Whatever the fake socialists think about Corbyn and their insane belief that Jeremy is going to deliver us all to some socialist paradise, they're completely wrong, of course. Both of them serve the establishment equally as much as the other. They do. Of course they do. Talked about this a million times. Fractional reserve banking. Tweeted about it today. Listening to the two of them, I mean, it's chalk and cheese, isn't it? Isn't it? You've got the vivacious, kind of mad, lunatic optimism of the crazy-haired Johnson, and you have the mumbling, stuttering, absolutely depressive Jeremy Corbyn. It's hilarious.
Johnson will be making a statement to the House on Thursday and setting out his general approach, and we'll be setting out our approach of a decent investment-led society that delivers for every part of Britain and all communities.
What do you mean by appropriate time?
Good question. When are you going to table this no confidence motion, Jezza?
When will that be? Will that be before recess or after?
We'll decide when that will be. It'll be...
We'll decide.
...an interesting surprise for all of you.
But you are guaranteeing that you will definitely be tabling one?
We will do a motion of no confidence at a time of our choosing.
Corbyn is wretched, isn't he? Isn't he wretched? And of course, if I was still of the belief that we could change things through voting, of course he would be my natural bedfellow. Yes, of course he would. But he isn't. He's a disaster, isn't he? Anyway, Jacob Rees-Mogg, terminological inexactitude, darling. He was like the cat that got the bloody cream, so he was.
So it's a terrific result, a marvellous margin of victory. It gives Boris Johnson a very significant mandate, and it's a great opportunity for the country to make Brexit a success. So now I'm hugely encouraged.
Will he be able to unite the party and the country?
He will unite the party and the country. Once we've left the European Union, almost nobody will ever want to rejoin such a failing organisation. So it's a terrific opportunity for unity and positivity for this great nation. It's very good news Boris has done so well. Look, I've been supporting Boris for a long time. He has my complete support. If he wants me to do anything for him, I'll of course do it. But the key is that we deliver Brexit and deliver what the country needs. Not about me.
Yeah, it's not about you. Now, that was Mogg being stopped on the street by a reporter. Later on, he joined Adam Bolton near Westminster. And Adam Bolton asked Jacob Rees-Mogg, are we now closer with the appointment of Johnson, are we closer to a no-deal Brexit on October 31st? What did he say?
It's, in my view, the more likely it is that you'll leave without a deal, the less likely it is you'll leave without a deal, because it's so key to the negotiating strategy.
and that the European Union tends to respond to pressure and to deadlines. And therefore, if it looks as if we might leave without a deal on the 24th of October, we're more likely to get a deal by the 31st of October. If, on the other hand, we were to take it off the table now, oddly, we might get absolutely nowhere in the next 3 months. So it's an absolute crucial part of the negotiating strategy.
I mean, just physically, there's an awful lot to do in an incredibly short period of time now, isn't there?
Work expands to fill the time available, as we all know. When you're writing your brilliant pieces for the Sunday Times, and sometimes you're squeezed for time, you always get it done, don't you? When you've got a week to do it, you don't even start. And a deadline focuses people's minds like nothing else.
He's got a lovely turn of phrase, doesn't he, Moggy? Work expands to fill the time available, doesn't it? I suppose it does. I don't have any time available ever. Consumed by work am I, but anyway, that's neither here nor there. I'm not going to cry to you. Don't bitch to me, Richie, I heard you say. I'm not bitching to you, I'm just telling you. Anyway, it's all theatre. It's all theatre. Doesn't matter who gets in. Doesn't matter what colour mast, what banner they walk under, it matters not. I said this today. Somebody tweeted today, oh, Boris is the banker's politician, is he? And Jeremy Corbyn is not, then. You really believe that? You really believe that Jeremy is not a banker's politician? Corbyn frames everything, every plan, every objective that he has, he frames it within the current financial system. It's all laid out within the current financial system. We'll have to borrow for this and we'll borrow to invest. We'll borrow, we'll borrow, we'll borrow. He's as much a slave to fractional reserve banking, central banking, and the financial elites of the world as Johnson is. He's no different. This is why it doesn't amount to anything other than a hill of beans. But it's amusing to me, because if I have a mission, and I don't really, you know, I like hearing from people who've got things to say, it would be to educate the world. Lofty ambition, that. I'll be lucky to educate Salford. On how money is created. Because those who control the creation of money control every single thing on planet Earth. And Jeremy, the fake socialist Corbyn, has never and will never speak of that to any man, woman or child. This is true, you see. This is true. Bit of high comedy today on BBC Radio 5 Live. The BBC's wunderkind, Emma Barnett, came from nowhere. Emma, I talked about her quite a bit recently. Daily radio show on 5 Live. And one of the three female presenters of BBC Newsnight. Well, Emma Barnett spoke with Boris Johnson's father, Stanley. Stanley himself, a former Tory MP. This, dear listener, is high comedy. Listen to Emma Barnett. I love these people like Barnett, you know. And I've gotten into who she is in the past with no self-awareness whatsoever. None. So narcissistic, so self-obsessed, not a shred of self-awareness in her body. Why do I say that? Listen to what she says to Boris Johnson's father, Stanley Johnson, and laugh along with me.
Is your son nervous about his new job?
I very much doubt if he's nervous. I very much doubt. I mean, this is a man who, you know, he's been through a tough English education. You know, he's played.
I don't think anyone's going to be crying tears of worry for Boris Johnson going through Eton and then Oxford.
What? Emma Barnett is taking the piss out of Stanley Johnson about the cushy private education enjoyed by new Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We'll come back to that one.
Now, come on, but you know, oh, he's grown up on an Exmoor farm. And, you know.
Doesn't fall far from the tree, does it, the apple? I think if you go to one of these private schools, or if you head down to Oxbridge, or any of these places where they hang out, if you talk like that, they will understand exactly what it is you're saying. That's the way to communicate with these people. Just do that. And they'll probably give you a recipe for dip or something in reply or in response. Anyway, so she's had a little pop at him there about the private education, didn't she? She had a pop.
Tears of worry for Boris Johnson going through Eton and then Oxford.
Now, come. common, but you know, oh, he's grown up on an Exmoor farm, and you know, okay, it's a tough assignment, but don't tell me it's not doable. I can think of people, you know, who've managed to do it very, very competently, and you might say, well, were they really, you know, desperately qualified for it? Well, the answer is, you rise to the challenge.
Yes, the BBC wunderkind Emma Barnett, the Jewish princess, poking Stanley Johnson about the private education of his son, the Prime Minister.
What kind of fuckery is this?
Yeah. Who paid for your private education, Emma? Ah, yes, it was your daddy. How did he do that, Emma? Ah, right, he used trafficked young girls in brothels in the northwest. Ah, yeah. That's what paid for your very expensive private education, lass. Complete lack of self-awareness, humility, none of it on display, Emma Barnett there at BBC Radio 5 Live today. Isn't it hilarious? Yes, Daddy did pay for her very expensive private education through the proceeds of the filthy brothels that he run in the Northwest. Yeah. And we believe that Emma Barnett knew all about the brothels. Doesn't mind too much that. Well, her career advanced at the rate of knots through the BBC, and it was helped along by the miserable suffering of trafficked young women and her gangster daddy. Lovely. This is the Richie Allen Show. It's 19 and a half minutes past the hour. Low blow? Not at all. It's not a low blow. Put yourself out there. Well, it's going to happen. People are going to talk about it. People are going to bring it up. Don't be taking the piss out of Boris Johnson's private education when your own daddy provided you with yours, you know. Have some humility, girl. It could just be the heat is going to my head. This is your Richie Allen Show on Tuesday, July 23rd, 2019. Yeah! This is the Big Geraniums and a song called Home Again. Great to be with ya. Right, the Big Geraniums, Home Again on the Richie Allen Show. Let's get rid of the music. 22 and a half minutes past the hour. Now, you'll know because it's been in every single newspaper today, most of the front pages as well, that Carl Beach of Gloucester was found guilty of 12 counts of perverting the course of justice and one of fraud in Newcastle yesterday. His lies, alleges the BBC, his lies led to a £2 million Metropolitan Police investigation which ended in no arrests or charges being made. He was known to the media as Nick. He accused senior politicians as well as army and security chiefs of sadistic sexual abuse, and he said he'd witnessed boys being murdered in the 70s and 80s. Operation Midland, which went on for 2 years, which resulted from the allegations by the guy Nick, Carl Beach, the former NSPCC volunteer. That operation closed in March 2016. The recriminations have been, well, coming thick and fast today, with the press asking questions of Tom Watson, the deputy leader of the Labour Party, a man who endorsed Nick back in 2013. So what's going on? Let's welcome back to the programme former senior barrister, former immigration judge, political activist and the author of the terrific book Spy Hunter. Always a pleasure to welcome back Michael Shrimpton to the programme. Michael, thanks for your time as always. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Fine. Great pleasure to be on the programme.
Thanks for doing it. I knew if I called you tomorrow there'd be no chance. We got a test match tomorrow. 4 days.
There's a test match. Yes, we are playing.
The Irish are in Lords tomorrow. Let's hope it lasts for four days, Michael.
I shall be at Lords, yes.
Let's pray that it lasts for 4 days. That's all I'm hoping for. Let's get four days of play.
Indeed.
Now, let's talk about Carl Beach. When I mentioned this to you yesterday and invited you to come on, you said Beach, to quote you, you said it was a put-up job. What did you mean by that?
What I mean is that Beach was clearly working with GO2, either directly or indirectly, probably indirectly through a Metropolitan Police officer asset of GO2, which is the German intelligence operation in London. And his role was to make fake allegations with a view to damaging the real allegations which had been made of a paedophile ring operating at the heart of Whitehall.
You believe this because you and I have spoken many times about the real reason Edward Heath took the United Kingdom This is Prime Minister Edward Heath in the early 70s. Yeah. He took us into the European Union on unfavourable terms because he was being blackmailed by German intelligence, you believe.
Well, that's right. He was not being blackmailed by German intelligence. He was being supplied with boys by German intelligence. Heath was gay and a paedophile, and he was particularly attracted to young boys around about the age of 14, some younger, some older. And like all sexual predators, he was a weak man, and he had difficulty forming sexual relations with adults, and he quite liked to bully. You know, he was a man who could only have sex with children. Sex for him was about dominance and power, and he was a very unpleasant man. He and I never got on at all. I'm rather glad we didn't. I didn't know the worst of him when he was alive and we were in occasional touch with each other. Heath was being supplied with boys by a paedophile ring led by an obnoxious paedophile called Jimmy Savile. Some of your listeners will have heard of him. And that ring was being protected by the Cabinet Office. Heath's Cabinet Secretary, John Hunt, was also being supplied with boys. He was also a paedophile.
Now, this is very interesting to me, Michael, because we've talked about this over the years. It's really important to talk about it again, and I'm glad you're on to talk about it. You talk about, you know, the Cabinet Office knowing this and obviously yes. not doing anything. British intelligence must have known and not done anything. And I don't want to spend too much time talking about German intelligence because I know you're a committed believer that it began with them. But why was British intelligence and the Cabinet Office basically sitting on their hands while this was happening with Edward Heath?
Well, the Cabinet Office is part of the German government, not the British government. It's seen as part of the British government because it's based in London and because it is always headed by a Brit. But in fact, the initiative to set up the Cabinet Office came from the Imperial German Secret Service. It was set up in 1916 in order to concentrate power in Whitehall to make it easier for Germany to control Whitehall. They selected a German spy called Maurice Hankey. He was the most important figure in the British government up until he resigned. Not long before the Munich conference. And of course, he nominated his successor, another German spy called Sir Edward Bridges. Now,
how do we know they were spying for Germany? Were they ever charged and convicted with it?
They're outed in Spy Hunter, but there's no doubt that the first five cabinet secretaries were all German spies. They were all working for Germany. And the Cabinet Office is a self-perpetuating oligarchy. The Cabinet Secretary nominates his successor. The current Cabinet Secretary, Sir Mark Sedwill, was chosen by the notorious German spy, Jeremy Haywood, who is the man who sanctioned my arrest, and knowing it was a wrongful arrest, and it ordered the Ministry of Defence to destroy documents. The orders were given by a female civil servant in the Cabinet Office who's since been banished to Northern Ireland, but the initiative to arrest me came from him, or rather, it came from the director of GO2.
Jeremy Haywood is dead now, and he's not in any position to say, Michael, you're talking absolute bollocks. I never spied for Germany. He's not here to say that, but presumably he would.
I'm afraid there's nothing I could do about the laws of libel. You can only speak the truth about the dead in Britain. That's because of our libel laws. Our libel laws effectively prevent the truth about the living being known whilst they're still alive.
I'm well aware of it. As a journalist, I'm well schooled in libel law.
Yep, there's nothing I can't bring. Look, if I could bring Jeremy Haywood back to life, I would. And if I could ensure that he was put on trial for his crimes, I would be any too delighted.
Well, before we go back to where we came in and to talk about Nick, because it's very important, and paedophilia today, give me a scrap of evidence to support your contention that former Cabinet Secretary Jeremy Haywood was spying for the Germans. And look, I read Spy Hunter. Well, of course I did. Give me a scrap. Give me some evidence. Otherwise, we'll move on. Go on.
Well, he ordered my arrest. My arrest had to be ordered from the Cabinet Office. The Ministry of Defence admitted that they didn't call it. They didn't report my intelligence briefing to the Secretary of State for Defence. That nasty man, Philip Hammond, it was reported to the Cabinet Office. It's a matter of record. They destroyed their contemporaneous note of my briefing.
And you remain convinced. And look, one of the things I love about you, Michael, I met you when we were in London making television programmes, and I do have a lot of time for you. I wouldn't dare patronise you. I really like you. You've got a massive big brain on you. But you're so clever. You're too clever not to know that a lot of people listening to this will think, Shrimpton is mad. Like, this is the guy who said that the Germans were going to let a bomb off in London in the Olympics in 2012. Sure, that's crazy stuff. That's what they'll say, right?
That's what I call the Tojo complex, from which the CPS and Thames Valley Police suffered. Yes, a lot of people suffer from the Tojo complex. Like General Tojo, they are slow to grasp the significance of nuclear intelligence, and they cannot grasp that a nuclear device could create an enormous amount of energy from a very small package. General Tojo didn't believe that you could wipe out a city-sized strategic target with a single bomb, even after Hiroshima was destroyed by a single device dropped called Fatman.
Remind our listeners why you believe the Germans wanted to do that. Why was it to blame it on? I mean, I know this because we've spoken about it before. Remind our listeners why you think, before we go back to paedophilia, which is really important, why did they want to do that, in your opinion?
Well, the aim was dynastic change. The Queen, the Prince Philip, Prince William, Prince Harry, the Prince of Wales were all going to be at the opening ceremony. So the Cabinet Office and Cabinet Office assets in Buckingham Palace had arranged for all the key members of the royal family in the line for the throne ahead of the Duke of York to be in the same place at the same time, in breach of security protocols. You normally do not have the royal family gathered unless it's in a secure location like Buckingham Palace. But you wouldn't normally have everybody in line, the first, second, third, and fourth in line to the throne in the same place at the same time. That itself was a sign that something was amiss. The Cabinet Secretary, Jeremy Hayward, the then Cabinet Secretary, made sure, by the way, he wasn't going to be there, another sign that he was in on this. And the intent was dynastic change. I'm not saying for one moment the Duke of York, who I was at Lord's for that wonderful win over New Zealand, as was I. I'm not saying for one moment the Duke of York was in on the plot. He absolutely was not. The Germans thought that the Duke of York would be an unpopular king. And he was the Duke of York is no more a German spy than the Duke of Windsor.
Well, do you know, there are files being unsealed in America at the moment that make for very grim reading for the Duke of York. Let's be honest about it.
That's the Epstein nonsense. But that was an attempt to entrap him. I mean, that again...
Michael, stop now.
You've got German intelligence involved.
He associates with a notorious paedophile. He associates with a guy who's admitted procuring girls under the age of legal consent. He has a lot of questions to answer.
Epstein is targeting the Duke of York. Epstein is trying to compromise the Duke of York.
The girls who said they were brought to Prince Andrew when they were underage, they're telling lies, these girls, you believe?
Well, it's entirely possible. The whole thing is a trap.
So it's entirely possible that the Duke of York... Hang on, Michael. It's also entirely possible that the Duke of York is a paedophile.
Oh, he's not. No.
How do you know? We have to wait. Well, we have to wait and see what's in the files. We know that accusations have been made against him
to
law enforcement officials. Serious allegations.
Sure, Highness, but I'm very confident that he's not a paedophile. Very confident.
Well, I'm not. You know, it's not because I want him to be a paedophile. I'm not confident he's not a paedophile. Hey, listen, let me ask you. By the way, folks, if you haven't read Spy Hunter, it's a fantastic read. I mean, it really is. It's important. It's an important book, I believe. And I reckon you should check it out. Whatever you think of Michael, because when you come on with me, I get listeners afterwards going, why'd you bring on that eccentric lunatic? Then, hang on, I'm not insulting you. And then other people come on and say, Shrimpton is onto something. And I believe you are onto something, because when you say the Germans, you make me laugh. We're talking about the Frankfurt Rothschilds, but you don't agree with that, but I know that's the truth. So let's move on from that. Let's talk about Exaro News. They're gone now. You have Carl Beach. He's going to get a jail sentence. As a scholar of the law, Michael, one of the things that was very strange was in this trial of Carl Beach, Nick, the alleged fantasist, it was revealed to the jury that Nick had a conviction for downloading images back in the early part of this decade. Now, some legal minds have said, that's outrageous. That is not standard procedure. That actually went against his ability to get a fair trial. The jury should not be informed of any previous convictions. Is that right, Michael?
Yes. The judge has a discretion. The CPS made what is called a bad character application. That is now set on a statutory footing, and the judge has a discretion whether or not to admit evidence of bad character. Now, before the bad character law was codified, there was a common law rule that evidence of a similar fact could be introduced, so that if you were accused of a crime and you'd previously committed a crime with a similar modus operandi, then under what was called the similar fact rule, that evidence could be introduced. The basis for the common law rule was that it had some probative value. Possession of images, and of course that's, I was fitted up with possession of images in my case. Possession of images, it seems to me, is not so similar to the offences of which he was accused to have any probative value one way or the other. It might suggest a sexual interest in underage boys or girls. I'm not sure whether the images were of boys or girls. I think they were of boys, but I'm not sure.
I disagree with you, Michael, by the way, because if I was on that jury and I learned early on that the guy had a conviction of downloading the images or whatever, it would prejudice me against the man.
Oh, yes.
Undoubtedly,
I think that there's no doubt that the CPS, the intent of the CPS in introducing this conviction was to prejudice him in the minds of the jury.
Yeah.
And I think there's no doubt that once the jury were told about that conviction, that was the end of the case. And of course, the CPS followed a similar strategy in my case. In the bomb hoax trial, they held over the conviction, which they were desperate to get before the bomb hoax trial, even though the CPS knew full well it was a crock.
Yeah.
And the CPS had tried very, very successfully to keep critical witnesses away from me from cross-examination. The CPS knew the conviction was a crock. They nevertheless held it over me by way of a threat of a bad character application. In this case, they carried out the threat and they got the evidence before the jury. My own view is the judge, with respect, should not have permitted that evidence to go before the jury. The reason I say that is, although it had some limited probative value in the sense that it's not entirely irrelevant to the issues in the case, its prejudicial effect was overwhelming and deprived him of a right to a fair trial.
Fair enough. I hear you loud and clear. You're saying it did have some probative value because it speaks to the guy's integrity and his state of mind and all that. I totally agree with that.
I don't think the Court of Appeal will overturn the conviction. It gives some grounds for appeal, but I think the Court of Appeal will not disturb the conviction. The Court of Appeal, I'm afraid, with the greatest respect, have a very poor record and you can tell from the frankness that I'm not expecting to be made Lord Chancellor.
No, not anytime soon. No.
Entirely a matter for the new Prime Minister. If he invites me to be Lord Chancellor, of course I shall serve. That's entirely a matter for him, and it would be discourteous to refuse such an invitation.
Wouldn't it? And the salary that goes with it.
Entirely a matter for the Prime Minister. I don't anticipate being Lord Chancellor, therefore I don't anticipate any Court of Appeal judge ringing me up next week saying, Lord Chancellor, what were you doing on the Richie Allen show having a go at the Court of Appeal?
Well, that's it. Well, the fact you came on this show, regardless of the things that have happened to you in the past, the fact you've came on with me, you're finished anyway. Now, let me ask you, the judge has obviously been very selective then in what he allowed to be admitted and what he denied in terms of...
I think the ruling was wrong. I don't think... I hold no brief for Carl Beach. It was me who alerted Wiltshire Police in their inquiry into Heath. I warned Wiltshire Police in 2016 that Carl Beach was a put-up job and that what he was saying was completely untrue. So, and I think that was one of the first warnings to the police that Beach was a fraud. So I don't disagree with the conviction. I don't disagree with the allegation that
it's an operation. The whole thing looks like an operation. So let me ask you this.
It doesn't matter. Although I held no brief for Carl Beach whatsoever, and I think he's a fraud, and I briefed the police against him 3 years ago, I am totally in favour of fair trials. And if I become Lord Chancellor, which is unlikely, but a matter for the Prime Minister, if the Prime Minister invites me to be Lord Chancellor, your listeners may rest assured that I would do nothing whatsoever to interfere with the fairness of trials. I would want to see nothing but justice done.
And do you know what's interesting, Michael? I'll tell you what's interesting. Carl Beach's lawyers wanted to admit into evidence information about allegations made about Harvey Proctor in the 1980s in Newcastle. And Proctor was interviewed, and several claims were made about Proctor that he had interfered with boys under... Now, Proctor had a conviction for being with a 17-year-old kid. This is before the age of consent was lowered. But also, there were other allegations made about Proctor involving 13 and 14-year-old boys. Now, allegations do not mean that they were true, of course, but those allegations were there. There was witness, there was sworn testimony about Proctor. And Beach's lawyer or barrister wanted to introduce this to impugn Proctor's, you know, position, and the judge said no. So it's all very interesting.
Yes, you see, this is the difficulty. The judge has allowed the prosecution to adduce evidence of Proctor's bad character, and the judge has said that his conviction for downloading images could go in front of the jury. Well, I think that ruling with respect was wrong. If I were sitting on the Court of Appeal, which I won't be, but if I were sitting on the Court of Appeal, I would not allow it. I would overrule the judge. There's no chance of my sitting judicially on the case. I, having expressed a view, I would recuse myself if it came in front of the House of Lords and the Lord Chancellor was back sitting in the House of Lords as he or she should be. It matter for the new Lord Chancellor, whether it's me or somebody else, to get the Supreme Court abolished and bring back the House of Lords in its judicial
So back to where we came in, Michael. Let me jump back in, because this is important in the time we have, and we go off in tangents, you and I. Let's stay with the cover up then. So Beach is a put up job to deflect attention away from the reality of paedophilia in Westminster. We remember Tim Fortescue very well back in 1997. Talking about it being a common thing for MPs to get caught with boys, and then they would be left off the hook as long as they did what they were told in the future by the whip. So here we are in 2019. We have Alexis J's inquiry ongoing. Paedophilia in the power structure, in politics, at the top end of politics, still going on, still rampant?
Yes. Well, we saw the Madeleine McCann case. A German paedophile ring kidnaps a young girl. She was going to be supplied to a member of the European Commission for sexual abuse. So that although we shut down that ring, I had a hand, I'm pleased to say, in shutting down three paedophile rings in total as a result of that case, one in Brussels, one in Spain, and one in Sao Paulo in Brazil, or mainly operating in Sao Paulo in Brazil. You won't find so many kids disappearing off the streets of Sao Paulo these days, thank God. Number of kiddies disappearing off the streets of Paris and ending up in paedophile rings in Madrid is also gone down, thank God. Although we shut down three rings in that case, there's no doubt that we didn't shut down all of the rings operating. As far as I know, the Germans replaced the ring we shut down with another one. It's important for the Germans to be able to have leverage over members of the European Commission.
Yeah, but forget about the Germans for a minute, Michael. We've got our own paedophile rings. In this country, my understanding is... Let me finish my point very briefly, and then I'll get out of your way. It's my understanding that in this country, 10,000 children a year go missing in care. Now, just for my listeners, let me explain that. A lot of children are taken into care every year. Tens and tens of thousands are put into foster care for various reasons, sometimes sexual abuse, sometimes physical abuse, sometimes very dubious reasons. 10,000 go missing. That's an official figure. In other words, at 13 or 14, they run away from their foster families. Nobody's ever heard of them again. Number of very learned men and women have told me, some privately, some on this programme, that they are being trafficked. And it is by paedophile rings operating in the UK. Forget about the Germans for a minute. I know your obsession with the Germans. We have it in this country too, right?
Yes, but run by German intelligence. You see...
But Michael, that's preposterous. Let me just jump in for it. It's preposterous to suggest that the only paedophile rings existing are run by German intelligence. That's preposterous.
It would be preposterous to make that suggestion, but it's not the suggestion I'm making. What I'm saying is that the more important and more dangerous of the paedophile rings are protected by the Cabinet Office, who in turn control the police and the CPS. And have influence over local authorities, because most chief executives report to the Cabinet Office. The most dangerous and influential of the paedophile rings are run by GO2, the German operation in London. The trafficking of children for supplying to politicians and civil servants in exchange, and judges, in exchange for political favours, is a particularly and peculiarly German intelligence tactic. It's a disgraceful modus operandi, and it is particularly associated with Germany.
Well, let's say I believe that. Hang on, Mike. Michael, hang on. Hang on. Sorry, let me jump in. Your machine gun delivery is brilliant, but I got to jump in there. Right, let's just say I believe you and I agree with you that it's Germany. What is it then? To protect the integrity of the European Union? Is that what the whole thing is about?
Well, Germany, as we know, set up the European Union. Yes. The idea for the European Union came back in from Reich's Minister Funk's Ministry of Economic Affairs in 1939-41. We know the Germans control the European Union in conjunction with the French, who in turn are a client state of Germany. It's one of the means by which Germany exercises influence in its sphere of influence, which it includes, it defines that as including the UK. Germany sees the Ukraine plus the whole of the European Union as its sphere of influence. And one of the means by which it exercises influence is the use, supply of children to paedophiles in positions of power and authority.
And in America, Jeffrey Epstein was doing this. This is what Epstein was doing. Epstein was definitely working for intelligence agencies. If it wasn't Mossad...
Jeffrey Epstein is an operative, but he's not an operative of American intelligence. In my view, he's an operative of German intelligence.
Israeli intelligence. Well, we're not going to have that argument again. We're not going to have that row again, me and you. We had that row before. We will avoid having the same rows. That's what I love about you. We have all new rows. We won't have the row about Mossad and the German intelligence. So he's over there entrapping very powerful people on video. And I want to ask you this. So you believe then that right across Westminster, but some very powerful political figures on the right and on the left today, maybe frontbenchers, maybe shadow frontbenchers, maybe prominent MPs, are compromised. Some of these people will have been compromised with children, you believe?
Yeah, correct. Yes, and it's still going on. And it's very dangerous, and it needs to be stopped. And I hope the new Prime Minister will put a stop to it.
No chance, though.
Well, if I go into the Cabinet, then this is every chance.
I know if you get into the Cabinet. But well, Boris Johnson...
The Cabinet Secretary is fighting a desperate rearguard action at the moment to make sure I don't go into the Cabinet. So whether I go in or not is entirely a matter for the Prime Minister.
Well, you're not going to get recommended for a peerage because of your unfortunate legal affairs in the last few years. But let me just put this point to you.
There have been discussions, and clearly the convictions would go by way of a royal pardon, which the Cabinet Office is blocking. So the peerage and the royal pardon would go as a package. But again, that's entirely a matter for the sovereign, whether a royal pardon is granted, entirely a matter for the Prime Minister, whether he recommends my appointment as Lord Chancellor to the sovereign. I'm not saying I will be appointed. I don't think I will be, but it's entirely a matter for the Prime Minister.
Well, Les Hewitt says, the Germans, there are a lot of people in Germany. Michael should say who in Germany he's talking about. I believe he's talking about the Frankfurt Rothschilds. We've had this argument for years. I don't believe you. But anyway, I love you, but I don't believe you. Michael Shrimpton is our guest. Now, Boris Johnson says, come hell or high water, I'm taking us out of the European Union on October 31st. He's not, Michael, is he? It's not going to happen.
Yes, he is. No, I trust him. I believe him. I think he's a good man. That's why I've been supporting him in his leadership bid. I've said from the beginning I thought he would get it. He should have got it in 2016. I believe him. We're coming out, come hell or high water, on the 31st of October, probably with no deal because the Europeans won't give us a decent deal. Well, that's a matter for them. They won't put a decent deal on the table. Therefore, we'll be coming out without a deal.
It's my contention that we won't leave with no deal. Of course, we should do. We should have done the day after June 24th,
no
right?
No deal is good for Britain. It's bad for the Europeans because of the massive trade deficit.
Correct.
Which is exaggerated by the Rotterdam-Antwerp
fraud. Here's my contention now. Here's my contention. I believe that Johnson will do some sort of Brino thing where he'll come to some arrangement with them that he will sell as a win for him. I sound like Donald Trump now. He'll call it a win for him. But in fact, it'll be us still subjected to the pillars, you know, freedom of movement and all the rest of it. That's what's going to happen. We're not going to leave flatly with absolutely no deal. It's not going to happen.
We're going to leave without a deal. The May deal is dead in the water. So the leaving without a deal on the 31st of October is the default position. And I don't think there are the numbers in the House of Commons to block it. We saw an attempt made to statutorily prevent no deal, and that failed because of Labour rebels. Everybody's talking about Alan Duncan and these potential Tory rebels, including Philip Hammond. But these nutters, no offence intended, on the left wing of the party, these extreme left-wing loonies who believe in the European Union, actually believe in it. I mean, they're not very bright, no offence intended. These left-wing loonies are thankfully outnumbered by sensible people in the Labour Party, as we saw the last, you know, the media go on endlessly about there being no parliamentary majority for a no deal. In fact, the last time Parliament voted, the people attempting to block no deal failed. Not by very many votes, but they failed.
Well, it's going to be very interesting the next couple of weeks. Before recess, yes. There'll be a bit of manoeuvring. Corbyn said today that he's going to hold in reserve a tabling of no confidence in the government.
Well, I think he's right. Incidentally, I think it absolutely disgraceful that his medical records were handed to the cabinet secretary.
How does that happen?
The cabinet office should not have briefed the media about his private medical life.
Like quite rotten. I could speak to you all day, my friend. Thanks for coming back on to talk about this. I really appreciate it. I'm going to recommend Spy Hunter again, folks. If you haven't read it, it really is an important read.
My pleasure. I don't think I'll be prevented from coming on your programme because I'm in the government. I'm not expecting to be appointed, but as I say, the stranger things have happened.
Throwing your hat in the ring.
Serve if asked.
Well, look, enjoy the cricket tomorrow. Let's hope it goes, as I said earlier on, for 4 days. Let's hope the Irish can manage to bat for at least a day.
I think they'll be doing well to take the test match into a fourth day. England have a very strong team,
so
Ireland,
I, yeah.
New to test cricket, but I'm sure it'll be a good match, and I know the MCC committee will want as many MCC members there to show an interest in the test. That one of the reasons why I should be going is to, you know, we've invited Ireland to play a test match at Lord's. I think there ought to be a decent crowd, and I'm sure the pavilion will be, if not packed, it won't be quite as packed as it was for the World Cup final.
No, it won't.
But
no.
I'm sure.
But it's a landmark game. Ireland, as you said, are new to Test cricket. They've got to learn somehow. Maybe they won't, you know, collapse in the way I fear they will. We'll see tomorrow and over the next few days. Thanks for your time today, Michael. Really appreciate it, mate. And I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
My pleasure. Bye bye.
Cheers, Michael. Michael Shrimpton, live on the line from his home. A lot of tweets on that. Base Ninja tweets, Richie, how does Michael know that it's the Deutschlanders? He seems convinced it's them. How? Evidence, please, Mr. Shrimpton. I've been having this out with Michael Shrimpton for years. David Stanford asks, does he mean the Fourth Reich? He means the controlling Frankfurt Rothschilds, but he won't admit that. And ultimately, what he really believes, and I have some sympathy with him, is it's basically a German plot to keep order amongst politicians who might have anti-European Union sentiment or who might be opposed to the European Union or who might want to leave the European Union. And I'm not saying that he's right. I don't know. Ultimately, it's speculation, but I have a lot of sympathy with that. The European Union is a post-Nazi project. I've done endless programmes explaining how the European Union came to be and how many Nazi lawyers and officials were involved at the very beginning of it. Wonderful book called The Nazi Roots of the Brussels EU, which lays it bare. Absolutely right. So there's a lot of misdirection with Michael Shrimpton, deliberately. Very clever guy. But I think he's worth even persevering with, even though when Michael comes on, and I don't mean to do him a disservice because he's a very bright fella, obviously, but when he comes on, a lot of listeners turn off or they say, I'm not buying this. He keeps blaming the Germans for everything. Well, I think he's been very clever. Personally, but I could be wrong. It's coming up to 6 minutes to the top of the hour. This is the Richie Allen Show, live in Salford in Greater Manchester. It is the 23rd of July. We were talking, Michael and I, about England versus Ireland at Lord's tomorrow, a 4-day test match. I'd love to be there, but I'll be here with you, and I'll be watching it on the telly during the afternoon while I'm beavering away preparing the programme. I've got to make do with that. If I was living in London still, I might have taken a couple of days holiday and gone to see a bit of Ireland. That's Ireland versus England at Lord's. This is Cat Stevens, by the way. I'm going to grab a drink of water back with you in a couple of minutes. This is Wild World. Melting here. Mr. Cat Stevens and Wild World on the Richie Allen Show. I've had one or two tweets giving me some stick about Emma Barnett. I've been called a bully. Never been a bully in my life. Let me tell you, Emma Barnett's private education was funded by her parents. Her father's a pimp. They kept a brothel. Mum and dad were convicted. Dad went to prison. She knew this. And I've been sharing the story with a friend of mine, one of my great friends, and it's important to note that there were some very serious people working very hard when Barnett's career was taking off, because Barnett is absolutely dreadful as a broadcaster and as an examiner of politicians, a cross-examiner and interviewer. She is horrendous. I've used examples of it. Not fit for a community radio station with a transmitter with a 500 metre radius. I wouldn't put her on a radio station which only broadcasts to a half a kilometre radius. She's garbage. And yet her career has risen. It's stellar what's happened to her. And she is crap. All the more bizarre because of her background. Right? Very interesting. So don't say that you're being hard on this girl, Richie. I'm not. Doesn't matter whether she's a woman, a man, non-binary, trans, whatever the bloody hell. The fact is, it's a very interesting story. And as I said, as she was on the rise, there were people interfering with the Wikipedia page. There were people interfering with Google search results when people wanted to find out who this young woman was. Private education paid for by the trafficking of young women. Because when you run a brothel, it is inevitable some of the girls working for you are there against their will. No doubt about it. That's a fact, you see. And facts are still very important in 2019. At least they are on this programme anyway. Thanks for your tweets. Hi to Mwinga. Hi to Gail. How you doing, Gail? To David, who says, Daddy must have kept a little black book of clients with a bit of power. A, says David, I don't know, my friend, but I understand why you would ask that question, but I don't know. I find it fascinating. Nobody would rise within the organisation that she has risen in with the sort of background that she has. Now, she didn't traffic girls. She didn't run the brothel, but she profited from it. And there's a good deal of evidence to suggest that she knew all about it. What her parents were doing. You know, that would be the greatest barrier ever. That's the sort of thing that would embarrass an organisation like the BBC. You know, that's the sort of thing that she wouldn't even hear about. That senior management would be like, yeah, just let that Barnett woman go. Yeah. Give her a couple of late night programs and then just let her go, just don't use her anymore. But no, stellar rise, incredible really, in the organization. It's exactly 6 o'clock. While it's exactly 6 o'clock, let's get the headlines from Elena Casas at FSN. A little bit of headlines, because you know, you never know what's happened since we last heard from her. You know, I've not been paying attention because I've been speaking with you and Michael Shrimpton. Over to Elena.
From Feature Story News in Paris, I'm Elena Casas. Boris Johnson has been elected the new leader of the British Conservative Party and is due to become Prime Minister on Wednesday. South Korea has fired hundreds of warning shots at a Russian military aircraft that entered its airspace, and India has denied President Donald Trump's claims that Prime Minister Modi asked the US to mediate in the Kashmir dispute with Pakistan.
Cheers, Elena, thanks for that. This is the Richie Allen Show, by the way. How you doing? Welcome to it. My name is Richie Allen. But then you knew that, didn't you? Broadcasting live on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester, triggerwarning.tv, TuneIn Radio, and my own website, richieallen.co.uk. Europe's most listened to independent radio show. I'll be joined in a couple of minutes' time by the truly heroic Maggie Oliver. I can't wait for that. Maggie joins me. Any questions, any tweets, anything you'd like me to put to Maggie on your behalf, do tweet at Richie Allen Show. She's got a fantastic book out about her experience in the Greater Manchester Police Force, but also dealing with the absolute scourge of paedophilia, of girls being groomed by predatory Pakistani grooming gangs, predominantly in Rochdale and in Manchester. You don't want to miss this. We'll be talking about Maggie's book in a couple of minutes' time. Great to be with you, as always.
The Richie Allen Show relies on your support. Go to richieallen.co.uk and set up a monthly donation today.
Yeah, it's bloody hot. I mean, it's properly hot. It's not even funny. All right. So I'm going to play some French music while I get Maggie on. Yeah, I'm not going to do that again, am I? All right, just did it again. Don't make that bloody mistake. All right, there you go. All right. The heat gets to me, you see. This is the thing. This is Zaz from France. This is Zaz. This is brilliant. Maggie Oliver is next. Yes, that's a Zaz. Ni oui, ni non. My French is dreadful, but there you are. It's a self-titled record, by the way. Thanks to Paul for the tweet. How you doing, Paul? Nice to hear from you today. It is Scorchio here in Manchester. Temperature still above 30 degrees, but it's great to be with you as always. Thanks for tuning into the programme. Very special lady going to speak with us now. Brilliant that. I got to read the book, which I'm going to talk to you about briefly before we say hello to her. The incredible Survivors Fighting for Justice book by the great Maggie Oliver. Let me tell you very briefly about her. I know that in this part of the world, of course, she's held in great esteem and very high regard, as well she should be. She's a former detective constable with the Greater Manchester Police, and she spent 16 years, first of all as a police officer, and then, of course, as a detective. And if it wasn't for her, we wouldn't know about the systemic failure of Greater Manchester Police in protecting children from grooming gangs in Rochdale. We owe her a debt of gratitude, I think, everybody in this part of the world and beyond. She revealed how gangs of men, Asian men, were basically seducing young girls with alcohol before raping them repeatedly under threats of violence. And some of you will have seen the BBC television programme Three Girls, which aired in 2017, the dramatisation. I think it's one of the most watched programmes in recent years the BBC produced. She's got her own foundation now, which helps survivors of people who have been groomed, girls that have been groomed, even girls forced into marriage, and we'll talk about that as well. But the book has just been published, Survivors Fighting for Justice, and when I tell you that it's one of, if not the best and most gripping memoirs I've ever read, I really mean it, because it's like in two parts. She details what it's like as a young woman joining the police force, training, coming up, dealing with her colleagues, general policing, and then you have the horrors then of Rochdale. It's a fantastic read. Let's welcome back to the programme Maggie Oliver. Maggie, love having you back on. How are you?
Hi, Richie. Thank you for having me on again. I'm a bit worn out, to be honest, but I'm still plodding along, you know.
Yeah, I know you're worn out, and I mean it when I say thanks for coming on, because at this stage you'd be forgiven for saying, I've had enough now, I've had enough of press releases, I've had enough of interviews, I've had enough of meetings, enough of public speaking. But thanks for giving us your time. I meant every word of it, Maggie. The book is fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. I'm going to say it 100 times between now and the end of our conversation. Maggie Oliver, Fighting for Justice. The book is called Survivors. Folks, do you know, if you've got a young boy or a young girl who's at college, they're thinking about going into the police, if you set aside the horrors of Rochdale and what Maggie uncovered, it's a wonderful introduction to what life might be like as you set out on a career as a police officer. Do you know that, Maggie? It's absolutely brilliant. As much as I was intrigued by everything that happened with the grooming, which is obviously the most important thing, your telling of the story, you know, your husband coming to terms with life as a police officer, it's brilliant, Maggie.
Thank you. That means the world to me, Richie. And, you know, people really only know me because of the grooming. And every time I do an interview, I feel myself as though I'm like a record that's got stuck, talking about the same thing. And sometimes it goes through my head, oh, I bet people are sick to the back teeth of hearing what I've got to say. So I wanted my book to help the reader understand a little bit about who I am and perhaps understand why I was, you know, put in the position of having a choice, carry on with your job or resign. And I didn't think I could do that without including some of the story of my life. I mean, it's fine. There's a lot more. I could have filled two or three books. A lot was taken out because we didn't have enough pages.
Yeah.
But on even taking out of it all the other stuff about the grooming and the police and the CPS, you know, my own kids now have got a document of our life, and their dad and Macy, who, you know, that they couldn't recall because they were too young for a lot of those memories. So it's something that they will have forever as well. And that's on a personal level. But I think it gives a bit of a background to why and how I got to the place that I got to, really.
Yeah, it does. And it's so readable. It could be fiction, you know. It's not, of course, but it's so readable. And there's light relief in there. There's some smiley moments. I mean, I was laughing reading about you going into a classroom and you're surrounded by all these guys that they look like Bruce Willis, or they look like Vin Diesel, or they've all finished in the army and they're gone into the police, and you're there. Here's little old me. What chance do I have in the classroom? It's brilliant, Maggie. Really, it's so human, you know. And one little story before we talk about why you wrote the book, in terms of, you know, we saw the three girls, and I know, because I've been listening to you and reading you, I know that there were things left unsaid in Three Girls, and I want to talk about that in a second. Yeah. But it's a lovely story about you being called. Tell the story about the little boys who took the sausage roll, Maggie. Tell us that story. This is brilliant. Yeah, go ahead.
I think it was just one of the stories that I think explains or shows that I was always a little bit different. I mean, we had a big supermarket. I worked in Moss Side, and you know that these big supermarkets often have a zero tolerance attitude towards shoplifters. So as a police officer, you are told that you go in and you lock up and you arrest and all. Well, you know, I'm a mum of four kids, and I was, I don't know, a couple of years into my job, maybe, yeah, about a couple of years in, and I was sent to the big supermarket, and for a report of theft. And when I went in there, there was these four little kids like stood in the manager's office, about 11 years old, looking very bleak. And, you know, I think they thought it was a joke, actually. But I walked in and actually they'd eaten a sausage roll walking around the supermarket. And there's a zero tolerance attitude. And I'm thinking, this is bloody crazy. You know, I've got kids of this age. They've eaten a sausage roll. If I arrest these four kids, we've got, you know, four vans with two police officers in each van. We've got four appropriate adults. We've got four lots of lawyers. We've got, you know, for what? For like a 50p sausage roll. So I got the mums in and, you know, got them to pay for the sausage roll, tore them off a strip. And they probably got a good hiding when they got home. But
probably.
I nearly lost my job because it was, you know, I got hauled up before the chief inspector and, you know, with a serious face, he gave me a proper ticking off and said, you mustn't do that. And, but, you know, that was a little bit of an example of how I always saw things in a slightly different way. And I think that stayed with me throughout my career. And I think the reason I was like that was because I was a 41-year-old woman when I joined. And, you know, you do change as you grow older. And you see that things are not always, you know, black and white. And sometimes you have to look at the bigger picture, and that's what I always tried to do, to be honest, Richie.
Yeah,
but there
were a
lot
story,
of amusing, man, you know, moments along the way. And I loved what I did. You know, I did love it.
It shines out of the book, your love for the job and your love for people. And that was very revealing to me. You know, if I'd have been your boss, you know, regardless, you know, if I'd have been your boss, I would have said, Jesus, Maggie, you saved us an absolute nightmare there today. Thanks for that, you know, because as you said, four lots of parents, four lots of solicitors, four vans. I would have said, thanks be to God, we've got officers on the beat that have got more important things to do. But very revealing to me, the fact that you were threatened, basically. This is not the way to do it. You should have hauled them in. That's community policing, what you did.
Yeah, and you know, there were a lot of my colleagues who had the same attitudes, but, you know, I don't even know how the chief inspector managed to be serious when he was telling me off, because I found it all a bit comical in a way that it was such a big deal when it was, you know, at the end of the day, a sausage roll. But it was kind of an insight into it. You know, a lot of policing is about individual senior police officers. And if you get a senior police officer in a position of responsibility that actually has been promoted because he was useless at what he did, you are banging your head against a brick wall, really. We had some fantastic senior officers. You know, I could name, you know, four or five that were brilliant. And I've mentioned a couple of them in the book, because that they saw the bigger picture, but you had, you know, you had a significant number that had known nothing else except for policing. And there is an argument to be made that police officers should have had some life experience before they enter the job and before they get promoted. And I think we would have a very different kind of policing and attitudes towards not only grooming, but other, you know, at the end of the day, for me, as a police officer, the police is a police service. That's how I always saw it. And you only need a police force when the service falls apart. You know, we police by consent. We're there to keep the peace and to look after people. That's how I always saw it. But there were definitely two perspectives on policing. I mean, I still get nervous now. You know, I think it's been inbred in me that if I hear, you know, the blues and twos on a police car behind me, I immediately think, oh my God, what have I done?
Right.
But most people are, you know, genuine. Yeah, we might all speak on our mobile phone in the car sometimes, or we have a light that's gone out, or but it doesn't make us a criminal. The bad guys are, from my point of view, the really bad guys are the ones that we should be focusing on. If resources are scarce,
and they are,
but we have to make choices. And, you know, locking up four kids for eating a sausage roll is not good use of resources. And as a mum and a housewife who had to manage a budget, you know, probably that's the way I looked at that. And I still think it was the right way to look at it.
Of course.
Even though longer a police officer.
No, human being first and police officer second. You're absolutely right. Just before we move on to talk about the book and the central, obviously the central theme of the book, very briefly, wasn't it Tony Blair's government that introduced ridiculous targets for police forces around the country? And it led to the sort of attitude you talked about there.
Yeah, like the performance, we had performance indicators. And, you know, my book, the first grooming case that I was on was called Operation Augusta. And at that point in the early 2000s, policing was driven by what were called performance indicators. And they were targets, basically. So if a member of the public rang in and they'd had, you know, property stolen, like a theft from motor vehicle, property stolen out of the car, that was given priority over everything else, because it was a it reflected in performance in the targets. So you had response times and you had to, you know, have an outcome, you know, prosecution or find out who had stolen the property. But if and that was one of the performance indicators, as were burglaries and robberies and acquisitive crime. If you had an 11-year-old child who was being sexually being groomed and sexually abused, that didn't reflect on any performance indicators.
Right.
So actually, police forces, the police service didn't care about it. But that, you know, that a big part of the problem I have is that they talk the talk, and the public would think that, you know, you would automatically assume that a crime of that magnitude and that potentially destructive outcome for a child's life would mean it would be an absolute priority, but that wasn't the case.
So let's move on and talk about this then. Maggie, let me plug the book. I'm going to plug the bejesus out of the book now. It's a terrific read, folks. I can't endorse it highly enough. Maggie's book, Survivors Fighting for Justice, is a must read. It's such a human book. It's such a great human story. Maggie puts you right there with her, right along the path, right up to the time when she had to confront this. It really is superb. Survivors Fighting for Justice, all good online retailers and good bookshops, buy the book. I read the brilliant article. Sorry, go ahead, Maggie. Go ahead.
Just stay there while you've made that point. W.H. Smith Travel is different from W.H. Smith, and not all airports are stocking it. I believe that Manchester is just about to start, because I didn't know till last week that it wasn't being stocked. I hope that will be changed. But if people want it for going on holiday, which is a lot of the feedback I'm getting, they need to buy it either on Amazon online, or Asda are stocking it, or Waterstones, before they get to the airport.
They might not have it in the airport.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a good, right, well, thanks for that. I read Julie Bindel's piece, by the way. I know you met Julie. It's a brilliant article in the Telegraph about the book, and about meeting you and speaking with you over a bit of calamari, I believe. And it's a really, really great article. Well done, Julie Bindel. And you told Julie that one of the reasons for the book, you're so humble, Maggie, it's incredible. You've not got an ounce of ego or pretension about you. You wrote the book because one of the things that annoyed you was Three Girls was brilliant and it was very important, but you felt that it let the CPS, the Crown Prosecution Service, and the police, it left them off the hook a bit.
Yeah, I did feel that. And, you know, anything in life is a compromise. And, you know, I was the programme consultant on the drama, and I worked on it for 4 years. But there were things that were not said that I felt needed to be said. I think partly for me to be able to let go of it slightly in the way that I feel that my book documents all the facts, not just a selective view. I mean, the BBC did a fabulous job, I think, of explaining and educating the country about what grooming is. What I didn't feel it did was show the depths that the police and the CPS had gone to in order to make it a simple case to prosecute, or a simpler case to prosecute. And the collateral damage of doing that was that dozens of kids actually weren't heard, didn't have a voice. And so I felt the need to tell the story about what wasn't done as much as what was, because, as you know, Richie, you know, all police forces, but Greater Manchester Police, have a very powerful public relations juggernaut, and they are very powerful. They are the voices that are heard in the local press. They, even the press, will only go so far, and the BBC equally is a very political organisation. You know, they will not rock too many boats. So I think it was safe to tell the story of the victims in a way, but perhaps it wasn't as safe to really go down into the depths of the failures by the police and the establishment and the CPS. So I've tried to plug that gap, and I've tried to make it as simple and as clear to follow as I could with just the big issues, because there is still more, but you know, you can only do so much. And I've tried to take the reader through my journey and help them to try and be as shocked and feel the horror that I felt at each stage, as each separate failure was kind of made known to me. And I've still not got over some of those things, Richie, and I don't think I ever will.
I remember when we first spoke back in 2017, I could hear even then the bewilderment in your voice as we were talking about these things. Let me remind our listeners, former Detective Constable Maggie Oliver is on the line. We wouldn't know about the systemic failures of the police in Manchester and how they failed to look after the victims of grooming gangs in Rochdale without Maggie blowing the whistle on it. We wouldn't know about this stuff. She is heroic. You know, I'm not just saying that because she's here. I say it all the time. Thank God for her. She's the best of us, really. And put herself on the line and eventually resigned over it and blew the whistle on it. We've all seen Three Girls. These men were given alcohol and cigarettes and everything else to seduce very young girls who didn't know any better. And then they were raping them and doing horrific things to them. And Maggie's on the line to us now. And just to touch on what you said there about the stuff that maybe the BBC might have focused on. I mean, talk to us about when you were on the Operation Augusta. Talk to us about, you know, having all that evidence gathered, hundreds of suspects, lists with evidence, with hard evidence. Even one of the suspects turned out to be a serving police officer, which is absolutely incredible, really. You have all this stuff there. It's all there. It's packaged. It's delivered. It should be sent to the Crown Prosecution Service, the Director of Public Prosecutions, excuse me, and people should be arrested and charged. Nothing, Maggie.
I think that's more likely to be me, Richie.
Yeah. I mean, and we talked about this in 2017. Talk about that again, that bewilderment at that stage, you know, your superior officers handed all this stuff, not doing anything.
Yeah, I still find it incredible and unbelievable. And, you know, and actually alongside Three Girls, there was the documentary called The Betrayed Girls, made by Henry Singer. Very, very well-renowned documentary maker. And he tells the story of Operation Augusta through the voices of various people, including me. But I've lost my thread. But in relation to that documentary, for instance, the mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, who is meant to hold policing Manchester to account, he set up an independent inquiry into what had happened in Operation Augusta. And I've spent, you know, many hours, as have other people, being interviewed by the independent team. Well, we're now nearly 3 years on from that, and we still haven't had any kind of an acknowledgement of the failures or an explanation of why it happened. I could never get my head around why they dropped that job, because I worked on it for a year and a half, more than a year and a half. And my husband, Norman, he was terminally ill, as I've spoken about it, as you know, in the book, Richie. And when I left work in March 2005 to look after Norman in his final few weeks, that job was being run by the major incident team. All the information we'd gathered about, you know, suspects and registration numbers, locations, victims, social workers who had been banging on for years about what was going on, that was all being put onto a Holmes database. And anybody who knows anything about policing will know that the major incident team only deals with very serious jobs, not jobs that they are considering, are they a job? Serious jobs. That decision had been made by the top level of decision making people within Greater Manchester Police, including assistant chief constables, the chief constable. They had decided, based on what the Augusta team had uncovered, that was a major incident. So when I went off work and all that was being handled by major incident team, I thought that job was going to progress for another year or 2 years, men offenders be prosecuted for dozens of rapes. I came back to work a few months later and the job had been buried. They were not buried, completely buried, and not one single person had been charged with serious offences. Nobody had been charged with any sexual offences. I could not believe it. I had met these kids. I'd met many social workers who had been banging their heads against a brick wall, and I was just incredulous. But that job was a carbon copy of what subsequently happened in Operation Span. The modus operandi, the way the men operated, was identical. The victim profile was identical. The offender profile was identical. But my husband had just died, and I tried to be heard back in 2005, and nobody wanted to hear. But I didn't have any, there'd been a gap between the job being closed down and me coming back to work. There were no answers, but I didn't have evidence to support what I knew was the truth. And I wasn't in a very good place personally. I'd still got four kids, two of them at school. My husband had been with for 30 years, nearly had died. And reluctantly, I had to, I had to let it go. I couldn't do anything about it.
What was that truth, Maggie? That truth, because they closed down Operation Augusta, despite the body of work there and all that material, forensic gathering of evidence. You had gone to look after Norman. You're incredulous. Norman has passed away. The hardship of that you've described in the book, it's heartfelt. It really is. And then you find out that they've dropped it completely, and you know the truth, and the truth has got something to do with the 7th of July terrorist attack in London, which is extraordinary. Tell us about that.
Well, I didn't know that at that time, Richie, because obviously I didn't have access to the database anymore. It had been closed down. But a few years later, I became aware that the last entry on the database for Operation Augusta had been the night of the 6th of July 2005. Now, my husband, my Norman, had died on the 5th of July. It's burned in my head. Norman died on the 5th of July. The last entry was on the night of the 6th of July 2005. The morning of the 7th was the London bombing. Now, in my book, I have said people should make up their own minds. Yeah. But you'd be interested to hear, actually, Richie, and it's very relevant. I did an interview last week on one of the TV channels where that fact was brought up. And GMP were asked for a right of response. Their response was that the decision to close down Operation Augusta had been made in early 2004. Well, that is
A barefaced lie. It's a barefaced lie because the last entry, as you said, is on the 6th of July 2005. Yeah. And just in case one or two of our listeners haven't put the pieces together, we're talking about Asian, predominantly Asian men grooming young girls. It looks very like, and Maggie in the book is brilliant. She's very fair, Maggie. She says, look, these are the facts. You make your own mind up. Well, I'll tell you what I've concluded. I've concluded that somebody has decided this is a political hot potato, that after the 7th of, the following day you had the 7th of July terrorist attacks in London, somebody has decided, let's just drop this now because it's going to look like we're picking on Muslim men in the country. The situation is already inflamed with people's feelings around Muslim men. Let's just stop this investigation. What a barefaced lie that is to say it was closed down in 2004, Maggie.
Yeah, and I know, you know, I was working on that job in March 2005. The major incident team weren't brought onto it until December 2004. So it is a lie. But what I would say, because I am very fair, you know, I've tried, this is in my head every day. This has become a big part of my life. And I have spent many, I can't even tell you how many sleepless nights and days and months trying to reason what was going on. And I don't feel it is just as simple as that anymore. I do think that it's definitely about attitudes, in my opinion. But it is more than just an attitude. It's more than just the racial dynamics or the ethnicity of offenders. I think it's an attitude that comes from the top, that, you know, people at the bottom, the people at the top consider victims or survivors, children like this, as being, you know, less than human in some ways, that they don't deserve to be protected. But that attitude can be seen in things like the Grenfell Tower fire, you know, where those people in that tower block don't matter. But if it was their children in that tower block or their mums and dads, they would make sure that the cladding was not flammable. Hillsborough, you know, those people were written off as, you know, troublemakers and alcoholics, and the people at the top covered up what they were doing because they didn't want to be, you know, it's not worth look. You know, you look at even at the NHS, that is predominantly used by people who don't have money now to pay for private healthcare, and it's falling apart and crumbling. Schools, we don't have enough teachers, but, you know, the people at the top, they pay for private schooling, they go to boarding schools and Harrow and Eton. You know, they live in a different world, and the people that are running our country are from that section of society. So people at the bottom don't matter. But my horror was that, you know, chief constables started the road into policing at the place I started. They promised to uphold the law, to protect the vulnerable, to act with impartiality. And at what point do they let go of their conscience and focus on what the people at the top are telling them to do?
They took the oath you took. So, and we talked about this in 2017. So you believe that among the ruling elite, there is a callous disregard for people, but people are subhuman. They're not worthy of, of thinking about. They're dismissed. I have some sympathy for that. These guys that buried these investigations, they took an oath, as you quite rightly said, to protect people, and particularly to protect the most vulnerable in society. But what you were finding out, what you subsequently found out was that very powerful people got involved. In terms of politically powerful people got involved at the Home Office, Maggie, to tell police forces around the country to stop investigating these grooming gangs.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I didn't know that back in 2005, and I didn't know it when I resigned in 2012. I only found that out because these things are hidden. They are concealed. The BBC will never tell that, nor will the chief constable. They all, you know, club together and they protect the establishment rather than tell the truth. But the reason I found that out was purely because Nazir Afzal, who was the head of the CPS, halfway through Operation Span, he came on board. But he made it public that in 2008, the Home Office circulated police forces and told them that they should not investigate these kinds of crimes. And I wasn't aware of that until Nasir Afzal made that public. Now, that would make sense to me of what happened throughout the country, because this kind of crime was allowed to grow and evolve, not only in Rochdale, but in Rotherham and in Telford and in Oxford and in Huddersfield and Sheffield. And we've got cases coming out of our ears all over the country. And I am not, I always say I am not racist. For me, this is about the law. And the law says that a 40 or a 50 year old man cannot have sex with a 12 or a 13 year old child, get her pregnant and walk away as though he's done nothing wrong. And if it was my son, or, you know, somebody who lives across the way from me who was a 25-year-old or a 40-year-old man, he would be charged with rape. You know, we wouldn't be sending emails to police forces saying, well, we'll let him off. So there is some kind of a twisted mentality behind that. And if we don't have the rule of law, if we don't trust the police and we don't trust the CPS anymore because we can't, then we're going into a place where we're going to have people taking the law into their own hands. And, you know, I gave 16 years of my life to a job that I believed was there to protect the vulnerable from the bad guys. So, you know, I'm not trying to destroy anything. I am trying to say we have to have a criminal justice system that members of the public can trust. And now, even though I was a police officer, even I don't trust it anymore, because it has failed me. It's failed generations of children. You know, where does that leave us as a country and as a society? It's a mess and it's a tragedy. And it's wickedness for me.
It is wicked, yeah.
Simple.
It should be blind, Maggie. You're right. You're very eloquent. It should be blind to race or religion. You know, justice should be blind to all of that.
Yeah.
It's a simple, it should come down to the facts, what can be proven, what can't be proven. Maggie Oliver is our guest. I've got the book in my hand here. I've read it. The future Mrs. Allen is going to read it next. She can't wait to get her hands on it. Maggie Oliver, Fighting for Justice Survivors. Maggie's battle to expose the Rochdale child abuse scandal. It's horrific. And just to pick up on something, it's my fault. Maggie was talking about Operation Span there. Operation Span, Augusta was shut down on July 6th, effectively 2005. In 2008, there was another inquiry which fell apart but was picked up again in 2010. That was called Operation Span, and Maggie was approached to join the team. And it was in 2010 then that Maggie realised just how horrendous this was, that they were sitting on, well, God knows how many cases, loads of evidence, loads of people that needed to be interviewed, loads and loads of victims, dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds. And at that point it was bizarre, Maggie, because suspects were coming in to be interviewed even before you'd spoken to some of the victims. This is in 2010. I mean, you must have thought to yourself then, this is just massive. This is beyond the scope of most people's understanding of what was going on.
Well, even beyond mine. You know, the way I'm speaking now, we're in 2019. It's taken me 15 years to piece this all together. And, you know, what happened on Augusta really was repeated again on Operation Span. But before I mean, the drama does cover this in a way. It doesn't cover much of my story, to be honest. But there is a scene where I go in and I tell them I'm not interested in going on this job because of what I've already seen in 2005. But I was given cast iron guarantees that there would not be a repeat of this, that if kids came on board to tell us what had happened, they would not change their minds. And, you know, that the abuse had long since finished. These kids that we were approaching were no longer being abused. They had come out of that cesspit, if you like. They had managed to escape. So I was tasked with going back to persuade them to put themselves back into that horrendous place, that the worst place that they'd ever been in their lives, purely for the public good, so that these men could finally be convicted of having abused dozens of kids. And when these kids eventually agreed to do that and put themselves through months of horror, of video interviews and audio interviews and going to ID parades and picking out their abusers, taking me to locations to show where the abuse had happened, and, you know, shops where they'd been taken and houses where they'd been, groups of men in one room, a list on the back of the door where they've ticked off every time they've used the house to abuse a different child. You know, that those things, that though I feel that that is, I am humbled and honoured that those children trusted me enough to tell me those things and to help the police. I only went and approached them because I had been promised there would not be a repeat of Augusta. And ultimately, I wanted to put the paedophiles away so they couldn't do it to other children. So when I see things happening like 6 or 7 months later that started to make the hairs on the back of my neck stand up again, I couldn't make sense of it. But when they finally decided that they were not going to honour the commitments to these kids, I really felt that I had to make a stand this second time. But even at that point, Richie, it took me 18 months, well, 15 months before I finally resigned, because I still couldn't believe that the chief constable knew what was going on, that the Home Office knew what was going on. My federation turned their back on me. The IPCC wouldn't listen to me. The head of the Serious Crime Division threatened me. That, you know, it was a long journey to me speaking publicly.
What's inside you, Maggie? I've never met you. No, then, because I've never met you. I would have loved to have gone to see you in Macclesfield last Sunday, but due to doing a programme on Sunday and getting it on air, I couldn't do that. But I'd love to meet you, and hopefully we'll have a cup of tea someday in Manchester. Yeah. Where did you find the fortitude to deal with all of that? The barriers, you know, the cold shoulder, the dirty looks, the obfuscation, the obtuse behaviour. How did you fight through all of that?
I don't really know, because it nearly did destroy me. And it really, really was the worst 2 years of my whole life. And I have been through some, well, I won't swear, but I have been through some tough times in my life. And that 2 years was without a shadow of a doubt the hardest, because when Norman died, I couldn't have saved him. Nothing would bring him back. When Macy died, my little granddaughter, nothing would bring her back. But this was, I always refer to it as willful blindness. It was negligence. We knew what was happening. We knew what the facts were, and the powers that be decided to turn the back on these kids. And in my heart, I was ashamed, but I couldn't sleep, and I was very naive at first, I think, because initially I thought it was one officer who I felt was blocking the inquiry. But I didn't want to cause problems for my colleagues, well, for one colleague in particular. And that kept me in this place where I didn't really know where to go. I didn't know anybody who had been through this before. But ultimately, when I'd been through every rank possible, I ended up, actually, that my last day at work, I ended up unconscious on the floor in the office with all my supervisors. And it was stress that had brought that on. Stress caused by this job, by where do I go with this? Because if I didn't speak out, in my mind, I'm as bad as those people who have turned their backs on these kids. And I just knew that I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do something about it. So it became a choice between my job and my conscience and what my kids thought about me as well. That's been a driving force for me. I want them to think of me, not embarrassed because I towed the line and didn't do the right thing. I wanted them to know that, you know, I'd stood up for what I believed in, and I'm still unshaken in the belief that what I did was the right thing, because I don't believe that the country would know what has gone on.
We wouldn't know, Maggie. We wouldn't have a clue. And I've said this a thousand times, without your bravery, we wouldn't know. Maggie Oliver's our guest. We've got about 7 or 8 minutes left on this. It's flown by. I want to talk about the foundation in a minute. The book is Fighting, it's Survivors is the book, Fighting for Justice. Don't trust that you can pick up a copy at the airport. Some of the airports don't have the book. Pick up the book online or at your local bookshop in your local town. I'm telling you, it's a fantastic read. It's gripping. It's also human. It's funny at times. It's horrifying as well, of course, at other times. You've got a genuine heroine here, Maggie Oliver. Maggie will be embarrassed, but I mean that from the bottom of my heart. No. Tell me this, right? You've done it. Do you think attitudes have changed within police stations around the country, or will they change? I dread your answer. What do you think?
I had many, many colleagues who felt the same as me. But as I was told when I was trying to be heard, you are just a detective constable. Senior officers make decisions. You do as you're told. And if you can't do that, maybe you're in the wrong job. Well, the tragedy and the shocking thing is that I believe that those people at the top of the police and the CPS and the government are more interested in covering up these mistakes and hiding the truth than they are in doing the right thing. And that's why I continue to bang on, because, you know, we've had no accountability, not one senior police officer. Think of every scandal in every town and city that we've had these cases around the country. Not one police officer, a senior police officer, has ever been held accountable. They try and make a scapegoat of a detective constable like me or some poor officer who's asking for help but doesn't, unfortunately, document it properly. You know, they are made scapegoats. I know from my journey from 2012 that there is a massive vacuum of help for survivors of abuse. They are, even if they get to court, they're cast out at the other end of the door. There is no counselling. There's no psychotherapy. They don't get criminal injuries compensation because nobody helps them to do that. And they don't know where to go. They are destroyed in many ways, even when they go to court, by the system, far more so than they are by the abuse itself. And that's why I'm starting the Maggie Oliver Foundation. As you mentioned, Richie, I had my launch event at Shrigley Hall in Macclesfield on Sunday, and it was a phenomenal event. It was mainly to announce that, you know, we're here. There's a long way to go to open my first centre, which will be in Rochdale, and I'm trying to generate coverage and attention for people. I'm going to need volunteers. I want access there for, you know, survivors to come where I can't help every kid personally. I do my best and I still support many of the kids in Rochdale. But every one of those kids wants somebody to hold the hand. You know, I know now what, up to a point, where I would take a survivor who needs counselling or psychotherapy or just somebody to listen to them. And that is not there for these kids. They are isolated. And I don't just want my centre to be for survivors of the grooming gangs. I want there to be a place in Rochdale and every city where a girl who's being subjected to female genital mutilation can go. Because within her own community, there is nowhere to go. They're isolated and they're scared and they are destroyed by what's happened to them. I mean, kids who also have been, not kids, young women who are forced into arranged marriages within the Pakistani community where the abusers and the groomers in these gangs came from, that there are many decent people in that community that I would like to join with me to push through the changes, to open up the debate. You know, girls in that community as well would have somewhere to go that is outside their community, because the community itself is a very closed and close-knit community where women are frightened to talk out. Very often, they don't even speak English. They are isolated, scared, and equally victims of abuse. So, you know, I'm trying to widen my work, not in any way to underplay this, but for me, the law is the law. So whether a paedophile who grooms gangs of girls in Rochdale is a Pakistani man, or whether it's, FGM is predominantly in the Somalian community, you know, the law is there to prosecute abusers. Whether it is somebody like Jimmy Savile, who was, you know, abused dozens or hundreds of girls. Some, you know, there are people that there are victims of these abusers who have nowhere to go. And I'd like my centre to be a place that helps those survivors who feel that they've been abandoned by society, that if you just want to come and have a cup of coffee until they feel comfortable, they're in a place of safety. And it's a big ask, and I would ask anybody who's listening to this to go on my we're starting we've just got a website. It's in the making. It's there. I've started a Just Giving page. I'm going to be looking for a little drop-in center where I can start a pilot, where we start, and then we look for corporate funding and public funding, because I know what is needed. I can't do it on my own, Richie, but yeah. I want there to be a place in every town and city for kids like this to go to. And I hope that my name will let people feel that they can trust me, and that to go to one of my centres, well, the first one, hopefully, and then more, that they will feel that they can be safe, that they will be heard. And it's not all about a prosecution. In fact, most of the time it isn't about a prosecution. It's about helping those people pick up the pieces of their broken lives that without that support at the right time will never recover. So I'm trying for my book to tell what has been and learn lessons from that to pave the way for what I hope will be. But it won't happen from the police and the CPS and the government. We are going to have to drive that ourselves and shame them into doing something about it, because that is really, in my opinion, why these trials are now very prevalent, because they've been shamed into having to do something about it. If it had slid away and been hidden, we wouldn't be seeing all these cases now.
No.
So, you know, I think they're all connected. So that's my aim, Richie. That's
we,
what I'm.
Do you know what, Maggie? Trying. We wouldn't be seeing these cases now if it wasn't for you and others. It's got nothing to do with a football hooligan running around outside court cases shouting his mouth off, by the way, just in case anybody's listening. The foundation, the Maggie Oliver Foundation, you know, the independent media, and I'm just one. You know, we do have a, collectively, we have a pretty broad reach. The independent media will do all it can to promote your foundation. There's no doubt about that. And the book, oh no, they will, Maggie, because it's a wonderful idea. The book, I swear to God, my listeners know me, they've been with me for years. I'm not a sellout. I don't endorse very much. The book is absolutely gripping. I haven't read anything like it. As far as a memoir goes, I can't remember the last time I was as moved by a book. It's called Survivors, by the legend that is the former detective constable, Maggie Oliver, who you've been listening to for the last 40 minutes or thereabouts. Maggie's website is Maggie Oliver, so it's Maggie 2 G's, i.e. MaggieOliver.co.uk. You'll find out more there, as Maggie said. You're a star, Maggie. You know, I'll give you the final word, and I mean it on behalf of everybody who lives in this country. Thank God for you and for what you did. Final word to you, and thanks for giving me your time today.
Thank you, Richie. I really appreciate you listening to me, and I just ask as you, your readers to read the book and make up their own minds, really, and please support my foundation, because that will make a difference if I get the backing. I promise everybody that the money that people donate will 100% make a difference. That's really all I can say.
I have no doubt that will be the case, Maggie. More power to you, and Godspeed to you in your efforts. And I know that when you do have information to share, and when there's progress with the foundation, you'll come back and update us. And do stay in touch with me over the email. Let me know next time you're around this neck of the woods in town. And I'd love to buy you a drink, Maggie. You deserve that much at least.
I'll take you up on that, Richie.
Listen,
a double vodka and Diet Coke.
Double vodka and Diet Coke. An aristocrat. An aristocrat I'm speaking to here.
No, just a cheap date.
Maggie, thanks so much for your time. God bless.
Thank you, Richie.
Speak again
thank
soon. Bye for now. The amazing Maggie Oliver, live on the Richie Allen Show there. And I've got the book in my hand, and it's a great read. All good online retailers, and it will be in your local bookshop for sure. Don't bank on it being at the airport. That sounds a bit weird, because it doesn't sound like a holiday read, but it is. It's a thriller that is, it's as page-turning as anything you'll read, but every bit of it is true. And as I said, it's like a book in two halves, because in the first half of the book, you're on Maggie's journey as, you know, not as a young policewoman, because she was 41 when she went into the force, but you're on that journey of her going to the training, being in the classrooms, dealing with all the highs and lows of that. You know, her indifferent husband, Norman, who she loved, who died some years ago, as she said herself, Maggie, back in 2005. And his kind of indifference, he was very supportive now, but his indifference to her going through that training and not, you know, understanding it. And it's just wonderful. I won't say any more about it. It's terrific. It is hugely supportive, Norman was, for Maggie. But being the husband of a police officer, how she describes that, it's absolutely amazing. Survivors by Maggie Oliver. Right, that's about it. It's absolutely scorching in Greater Manchester, and it's scorching in this studio. My God. We survived. We're approaching 4.5 minutes to the top of the hour. I'll be back with you tomorrow. I will, one way or another. I will be back with you, because I've got guests booked in, and I've got guests booked in on Thursday as well. I do. There's no escaping it. There's no escaping it. But it's rotten. And I've been explaining it to people who've been asking me on social media. The thing is, you see, this is our new place. And as of yet, I haven't had the opportunity to do certain things regarding the insulation and the ventilation, because the studio is basically a box. It's a big sized bedroom. It's not the box room. It's a big sized bedroom, a very big sized bedroom, in fact, thankfully. But because of sound issues. And I thought about today, actually, just leaving the windows open and acting like, basically, back in my mainstream days, we would do outside broadcasts and you would interview people at the side of the road. And you would hear cars passing in the distance and you would hear voices in the distance. So I thought about leaving the window open and doing the programme. And then, because I'm such a consummate professional, I thought, no, don't leave the window open, suffer in silence. But what I might do tomorrow is I might do the programme but leave all the windows and all the doors open. So you will hear things going on in the background, but you'll still be able to hear me. We'll see how it goes, because it's rotten. You might remember last summer in the heatwave, there were 3 days, I counted them, 3 days when it was impossible to do that programme. Because it was unbearable, and it's been unbearable today. But anyway, that doesn't matter. What matters is Maggie Oliver, an extraordinary woman. MaggieOliver.co.uk. And again, the book is called Survivors. Survivors Fighting for Justice. What a read that is. Right, that's it. Thanks to Michael, by the way. Michael Shrimpton in Air One. Thanks, Michael. This programme, of course, will be available on Podomatic, Spotify and iTunes, and it'll be repeating all the time on richieallen.co.uk. All right. Thanks to my guests. Thanks to you. Speak to you tomorrow at the usual time of 5 p.m. UK time. I have been Richie Allen, and this was your Richie Allen Show. Look after yourselves. Bye.